By far the most authoritative and eloquent chronicle of the first voyage around the world flowed from the pen of Antonio Pigafetta, who had faithfully maintained his diary throughout the entire expedition. To counter what he expected would be Elcano's self-serving distortions, Pigafetta immediately set about writing his own impassioned plea for Magellan's valor and loyalty to the king and the church. He provided eloquent eyewitness testimony about how Magellan had died and, more important, how he had lived. He revealed Magellan as the fearless disprover of long-standing myths and overturner of tenacious fallacies. Leaving Seville, Pigafetta headed directly for Valladolid. Pigafetta's diplomatic background served him well because he then succeeded in giving his account to other sovereigns who were often bitter enemies of one another. Pigafetta's thorough and even-handed distribution of his account ensured Magellan's leading role in the adventure for posterity, and not so incidentally, his own. After traveling across Europe, Pigafetta arrived in Venice, his home, and immediately caused a stir. In August of the following year, Pigafetta, by this time settled in Venice, requested that the Doge and City Council allow him to print his sensational account. He supplied two reasons: the overwhelming importance of the events recorded, and Pigafetta's singular authority in relating them. Pigafetta's request met with a favorable response, and he was granted the privilege that no other except himself be allowed to have it printed for 20 years. Although a few influential voices celebrated Magellan's extraordinary accomplishments and appreciated the extent of his ordeal, he was despised or discounted by most authorities and observers from Seville to Lisbon. In both countries, he was considered a traitor, and court historians everywhere prepared to blacken pages with their indictments of his nefarious deeds and treachery. Ironically, Magellan's most fervent admirers were in England, where political commentators urged their island nation to emulate his daring example. Closer to home, King João III of Portugal, the son of the monarch who had spurned Magellan, seethed at the news that one of the ships of the Armada de Malacca had returned to Seville with a full load of cloves. He hotly protested to King Charles, insisting that the Spice Islands actually belonged to Portugal. Charles, for his part, patiently but insistently pressed for the release of the men taken prisoner by the Portuguese in the Cape Verde Islands, and they trickled into Spain in small groups throughout the following year. Victoria's two groups of survivors, for all the hardships they had endured since leaving the Spice Islands, enjoyed far better fortune than the 60 men who had chosen to sail home aboard Trinidad. Only 4 of that number ever returned to Spain or Portugal. A deaf seaman named Juan Rodriguez, at 48, the oldest survivor, stowed away on a Portuguese ship bound for Lisbon. He spent a short time in jail, won his release, made his way back to Seville, and, despite his age, infirmity, and the hardships he had endured during his years at sea, applied to the Casa de Contratación to sail to the Indies once again. Enduring months of hard labor and humiliation in the Moluccas, Espinosa was transported along with several of his crew members to Cochin, a Portuguese outpost on the west coast of India. Refusing a Portuguese invitation to fight the Arabs, he wrote to King Charles, complaining that the viceroy, Vasco da Gama, was busy, as he said, menacing me and telling me that my head would be cut off, and dishonoring me with many evil words, saying that he would hang the others. In 1526, after 4 miserable years in captivity, Gonzalo Gomez de Espinosa, the former captain, and Ginez de Mafra, the garrulous pilot, joined the crew's gunner, Hans Varg, aboard a ship bound for Lisbon. Freedom would elude them a little while longer, though. On arrival, the heroic circumnavigators were thrown into jail. Varg died there, leaving all his worldly possessions, his back pay, and a package of cloves to Espinosa. Toughened by years of adversity, de Mafra and Espinosa survived their time in a Lisbon prison as they had survived everything else. Upon their release, they returned to Seville, only to be jailed again. Their case came to trial in 1527. At last, they were acquitted and finally released. Both men found their homecoming to be bitter indeed. Demophra, for one, learned that his wife, assuming that he was dead, had remarried. Not only that, she had spent his entire fortune with her new husband. Disgusted with his lot, Demophra returned to the life he knew best, that of a pilot in the Pacific. By 1542, he was back in the Philippines in the service of Spain. Espinosa faced a more ambiguous destiny. On August 24, 1527, King Charles granted him an enormous pension, 112,500 maravedis, but Espinosa never received it. The Casa de Contratación, as mean-spirited as ever, withheld the salary he earned during his years in jail, arguing that he was not actually in the service of Spain at the time. Outraged by the treatment he had received at the hands of unfeeling bureaucrats, he sued for twice the amount, settled for half the original pension, and, in the end, received only a fraction of the settlement. And even that modest amount was contingent on his participating in another expedition to the Moluccas. Understandably, Espinosa refused to return to the lands that had claimed the lives of so many Spaniards. In 1529, King Charles decided to bestow another pension on his loyal servant, this time in the amount of 30,000 maravedis, and he received a comfortable job as an inspector and an annual salary of 43,000 maravedis. He lived out his days in Seville. Spain and Portugal agreed to hold another conference to determine the locations of the line of demarcation in the Spice Islands. The Spanish delegates included experts such as Sebastian Elcano, Giovanni Vespucci, Amerigo's sibling, and Sebastian Cabot. Despite the good intentions of the two nations and the credentials of the delegates, the proceedings quickly degenerated into farce. To symbolize the strict impartiality of the deliberations, the summit was held on a bridge spanning the Guadiana River along the Spanish-Portuguese border, but the location nearly undid the conference. As the distinguished members of the Portuguese delegation happened to be walking across the bridge, they were stopped by a small boy, who asked if they were carving up the world with King Charles. The former governor of India, Diogo López de Siqueira, acknowledged that indeed they were. At that, the boy lifted his shirt, turned to reveal his bare bottom, and with his small finger traced the line between his buttocks. "Draw your line right through this place," he declared. The parties adjourned to towns on either side of the river. The cosmologists and astronomers continued to argue over longitude and could not even agree on the length of a degree, so the question of where to place the Moluccas remained unresolved. Magellan had traversed the Pacific, it was true, but no one yet knew how to measure the distance he had traveled, except by dead reckoning, of limited value over long distances. For all these reasons, the attempt to redefine the line of demarcation ended in failure. As might be expected, both sides claimed victory and possession of the Spice Islands. Blithely ignoring the conference, King Charles splurged on lavish follow-up expeditions to the Moluccas, heedless of the cost and the risks involved in these tragic enterprises.